Our next guest doesn't care what you think about her. She doesn't care how you feel unless she's using your emotions to manipulate you for her benefit. She's a liar and a schemer. She gets her jollies by inserting herself into your psyche and quietly wreaking as much havoc as she can. So how does all that square with teaching Sunday school, tithing to the Mormon church, teaching law, and serving clients as an attorney? M.E. Thomas says it's easy for someone with her personality disorder. The shrink who evaluated her calls her a psychopath. But M.E. Thomas chose a slightly less pejorative term for the title of her new book, Confessions of a Sociopath, on midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Call our next guest a psychopath, and it won't bother her a bit. After all, that's how a shrink diagnosed her. But she prefers the term sociopath. It has fewer criminal connotations. In fact, she notes, whether they're called psychopaths or sociopaths, most people with her personality disorder never commit a crime or physically harm anyone. They're content to scheme and lie and manipulate others, often for their own entertainment. They're short on empathy, don't feel normal emotions, and have no qualms about ruining other people's lives for their own benefit. But they often conceal their dark inner lives under a veneer of glibness and charm, and many have successful careers. In fact, M.E. Thomas argues, sociopaths make particularly good candidates for corporate CEOs. They have no trouble being ruthless. She says there's a good chance that you and I will have a run-in with a sociopath during our lifetimes without realizing it. That's because the highest functioning sociopaths are hiding in plain sight. And that's the subtitle she chose for her new book, Confessions of a Sociopath, a troubling memoir about her life and a personality disorder that made her feel separate from the rest of the world since childhood. The book is full of troubling moments. The day she let a baby opossum drown in her swimming pool and felt no remorse. The friend she dropped because her mother had cancer and she wasn't fun anymore. Her experiences as a lover who regards seduction as sport fishing. As soon as she catches her prey, she cuts him loose. She also boasts about her ability to hide her psychopathology, to make others like her, even love her, to have a successful legal career, and to be, for all intents and purposes, a pillar of the Mormon church, which she describes as the perfect place for sociopaths. M.E. Thomas, that's M period E period and not Emmy. M.E. Thomas is the pseudonym today's guest chose for her memoir, and if you read it, you'll understand why she took a nom de plume. She describes herself as a law professor, regular contributor to legal journals, and Sunday school teacher. But underneath the veneer, she's a diagnosed sociopath who founded a blog called sociopathworld.com. As a card-carrying sociopath, she concedes that she has no problem lying to further her schemes, so she'll just have to decide whether, we'll just have to decide whether she's telling the truth here today. The book, again, Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight, it's available from Crown Publishers. M.E. Thomas, welcome to Baltimore and Midday.
Thank you.
Thank you. And the first question, I don't normally ask authors this as a first question, but I have to ask someone who writes a book like this, you know, why did you write it and why now?
Yeah, why did I write it? So the book is a little bit of a continuation of a blog that I started writing. And I started writing the blog after a period of a lot of turmoil in my life. I had lost a job. I had lost several relationships all at the same time. And it wasn't the first time that it had happened. I had had similar experiences where my life seemed to just fall apart at least a couple times before. And I'm not even that old. And I started thinking, you know, something's wrong here. And what is the common denominator? It's me. I'm the same thing in all these situations. So maybe there's something that I'm doing here that is causing my life to self-destruct like this. So I started seeing a therapist, And that didn't really help that much. But in talking with the therapist, I remembered a conversation that I had had years earlier with somebody, an office coworker of mine. We had been talking all of that summer about ethics. She was very interested in ethics, and I also am very interested in ethics. And through these discussions, she got to know a lot about me, and after a few weeks said, you might want to consider the possibility that you're a sociopath. And at that time, I looked it up online, and I looked at the traits, and I thought, yeah, you know, these traits do seem to fit who I am. But at the time, I was doing really well, and it didn't really seem to have that much relevance to my life. But through these therapy sessions, years later, I started thinking, maybe there's something to this sociopath thing. Maybe this is why I'm self-destructing every few years. And so I started writing the blog because as I was looking for information to sort of help me understand who I was and possibly help me understand how I could possibly change my behavior, there wasn't really anything out there for sociopaths. All the advice was avoid sociopaths. Sociopaths, you can't help them. There's no treatment. And they're basically human garbage. And I thought, well, this can't be the whole story, right? So I started doing research and I started presenting the research that I found, trying to have a little bit more of a positive spin or at least a practical spin. You know, here are things possibly you can do, or here are things that you could possibly learn to understand yourself better and modify your behaviors. So writing the blog for several years, and then I wrote the book trying to reach a larger audience and trying to present a viewpoint that is sadly lacking even in the scientific and academic literature. You know, everything seems to be very pejorative. Everything seems to be very negative about sociopaths, and I just don't think it's true.
That's very interesting. I just wanted to tell you about my experience with the term sociopath versus psychopath, and I learned a lot more about it from the book. Sociopath, sort of a mild form of psychopath. Psychopath we associate with criminality, even serial murderers. Sociopath, someone who lacks a conscience, someone who lacks empathy for others. That's sort of my reading on that over the years. Every once in a while, a friend of mine who's familiar with psychiatry or psychology will throw that word in. Well, he's a sociopath. Or we might be discussing a news story about a criminal or someone who just behaves badly in public. Well, she's a sociopath. He's a sociopath. I wasn't never sure what that meant, but now I have a better understanding of it. You say in your book that when you researched this condition, it pretty much fit you like a glove.
Yeah, it fit me like a glove. And just to speak a little bit to the terminology, I don't think everybody agrees whether there's a distinction between sociopath or psychopath, or as the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Disorders, uses the term antisocial personality disorder. Hervey Cleckley, who is the father of modern psychopathy, he used the term sociopath. That's the term I use. And he used it because psychopath did have some bad connotations. Other people, Robert Hare, who is the author of the primary diagnostic criterion for psychopathy, uses psychopath. And then, as I said, the DSM uses antisocial personality disorder. There is a lot of disagreement whether there is a distinction between the two. To the extent that some people think that there is, people say sociopath is more socially caused, psychopath is more inborn. But really, there has been a dearth of research done about this, particularly when you compare it to something that's relatively even less common, like autism, where there has been a lot said, a lot discussed about autism, and you don't have the same sorts of stigma attached to autism. But you said earlier, how do the traits of sociopathy fit me? Mm-hmm. When I was looking up things, you look at the traits, they're not necessarily negative, which is interesting because, as you said, when people say sociopath, he's a sociopath in common parlance, they almost always mean something negative. In fact, it's considered so negative that if you call somebody a sociopath, I think in Australia, that's considered essentially per se defamation. You have defamed somebody by calling them a sociopath. And I think that it's because they're not using it in its proper scientific meaning, right? They're not actually referring to sociopath as they would something like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Nobody just throws out, oh, well, I guess maybe they do. Someone's bipolar means they're high and low. But sociopath has come to be sort of a synonym with evil, and that's not at all true. It's a mental disorder, and it's sort of shocking that we have let a mental disorder come to be equated with evil. And why? You know, if we already have a word for evil, we don't need the term sociopath. You know, I think it's really sort of, I should say, politically incorrect. You know, the same way that people used to say retarded, somebody's retarded, to mean that they are stupid or they're behaving stupidly, or even gay, something's gay. We hear that all the time now to mean something's lame, right? And I think that's really inappropriate. And you see it too with sociopaths. When you hear the word sociopath in media, it's almost always in reference to a politician, first of all, or somebody else who's crazy, but it's not actually calling that person a sociopath.
Right.
Traits of a sociopath that are neutral, I mean, they're charming. Sociopaths are charming. They're charismatic. They're relatively fearless. They're very confident. They don't get nervous in certain sorts of situations. They have a failure to conform to social norms, and sometimes that's going to mean that they're reckless. They definitely are, with the safety of themselves and others. And maybe that's going to... you know, maybe they're going to end up in prison because of it. Maybe they're going to become criminals, depending on their socioeconomic background. Or maybe they're going to become, as you said, CEOs, entrepreneurs, surgeons, firemen, spies, soldiers, right? They could just be scientists. Sociopaths tend to be independent thinkers. They tend to not just accept the norm.
Let me ask you this. Was I on the right track with lacking conscience, lacking empathy?
All right, definitely. So I think the trait that is most similar in my mind to some of these other traits are these disorders that I mentioned, you know, bipolar, borderline personality disorder, autism, is that sociopaths have a different emotional world than other people do. They do, right? So to the extent that we think of a conscience as you have feelings of guilt after you do something that you consider wrong, that you actually feel badly about something, sociopaths aren't going to necessarily have that. They don't give their emotions the same sorts of meaning that other people do, like somebody with autism, right?
Yeah.
And lack of empathy, you know, they don't really understand their own emotional world. And so they're not really going to be able to understand your emotional world either. There's a disconnect there. There's a way they perceive their emotions differently. It's almost as if I perceive emotions without context. They show up and they feel the same way to me that feelings of hunger or feelings of, you know, nausea or feelings of exhaustion feel to me. I don't necessarily think that I'm an exhausted person or I'm a nauseated person. When I do that, the same way that I think people, when they feel love, normal people, they think I'm a loving person. This is part of my identity, is I'm a person who loves.
A sociopath also can be quite charming and smiles a lot. True?
Yeah, I think sociopaths, they're friendly. I mean, they have nothing really to gain by taking a stance and making enemies. You know, sociopaths make friends. You imagine a common social situation. Let's say you have somebody who's kind of fat, you know. What are the sorts of reactions you might have to somebody who's fat? Fat and wearing really tight clothing, inappropriate clothing for that person, right? Mm-hmm. The reaction that you might expect from a lot of people is for them to shame the fat person. You know, hey, fatty, you know, you really shouldn't be wearing this tube top. You can't pull it off, right? Why? Why would somebody do that? You know, what is there to gain in shaming somebody? You're enforcing a social norm, yes, but is this social norm moral? Or does it have any sort of practical relevance? You know, we know that beauty is relative, right? So just mm-hmm. because you don't find that attractive doesn't mean that other people don't find it attractive. And also, it's cultural, right? It's changed over the years. It used to be that fat people were considered very attractive. So for you to go out of your way to make somebody feel badly about being fat, you know, that is the sort of surprising to me. These are the sorts of social norms that I really, really don't understand. And what would a sociopath do? Would a sociopath go out of their way to make enemies with somebody who's fat and wearing a tube top? No, because there's absolutely no benefit to it. If anything, they're going to be nice and charming and smiling to this person too, because why not make a friend? Why make an enemy?
Well, let me ask you about that. Okay, so you're charming, you make a friend here, but it's a friend that maybe you want to manipulate, a friend maybe later you want to make feel bad, correct?
Well, it's definitely a friend that's not an enemy. I don't know why you would want to make the person feel bad. I mean, people say this sort of thing like sociopaths manipulate, as mm-hmm. if that is exclusive to sociopaths. Mm-hmm. If you have ever been on an online dating website and you want to see people manipulating or lying to each other mm-hmm. or trying to present, you know, what are these people trying to do? Are you trying to manipulate somebody when you pick them up in a bar and you don't, within the first 10 minutes, tell them that you don't make, you know, as much money as they might hope, or, you know, you don't have, you're not as fit as you would hope to be, or you have these emotional problems? You know,
so,
everybody.
So, Amy,
kind
excuse
of,
me then. Then how do we decide who's a sociopath and who isn't?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, you sort of answered the question earlier with, do you, most people have a conscience and empathy? I think that those are the primary distinguishing characteristics of a sociopath.
All right, we'll take a little break here and come back and continue our conversation. I'm speaking with M.E. Thomas, the nom de plume our guest chose for her new book called Confessions of a Sociopath, where she describes life as a schemer, liar, a manipulator hidden under the veneer of a church-going law professor. She says there are plenty of sociopaths like her hiding in plain sight, but if they're good at it, we'll never know unless they decide it's time to ruin some little facet of our lives. More with Emmy Thomas after a short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, our guest Emmy Thomas, her book Confessions of a Sociopath. You actually had a psychiatrist tell you or use the term a psychopath, right? For you.
Yeah, I've been diagnosed as a sociopath, psychopath, and I'm very clear to say, you know, I've been diagnosed as one. I don't even know if I am one. I just have these particular traits and the particular label that has been used to associate or to describe people with my traits is sociopath or psychopath.
Mm-hmm. Well, do they say psychiatry? Does it generally say there's no help for psychopaths or sociopaths, that it's untreatable because of the way you're wired?
That is the common wisdom, but there has only been one study in all of psychiatry to determine whether sociopaths or psychopaths can be treated. So do I believe that story? I guess I don't really.
Mm-hmm. Is there something about yourself that you would want to change? Could you name a couple of things about yourself you don't like that you'd like to change?
Yeah, there are a lot of things about myself that I'd like to change. You know, I think the primary reason why I consider sociopathy to be a disorder and not just a different variant of a personality is the inability to sort of form emotional connections with other people, right? Sociopaths lack empathy. Sociopaths don't really understand their own emotions. And so this can be a struggle when trying to form intimate emotional bonds with another person. It's something that I've struggled with in my life. My mm-hmm. typical relationships, romantic relationships at least, last, you know, maybe 3 months. And my most recent one that was long, 8 months. And that was, you know, doing very well, I thought.
So you think sociopaths are born or made? Have you made up your mind about that, Emmy?
I think that the twin studies have shown that there's definitely a genetic component to it, but it can't be everything. I think most people think that it's about 50-50, that you have genetic propensities and that there are certain things about your environment or something else that's not your strict DNA that is leading you to develop these particular traits, perhaps because they happen to be the most efficient. They happen to be what's useful to you in a particular situation. When you look at sociopaths with low socioeconomic status, then they tend to be more criminal. They tend to manifest the traits in different ways. When you look at people with higher socioeconomic status, these people, instead of going out and stealing cars to get a thrill, they're skiing in the Alps.
And tell me about your law career and your personality disorder, your personality. Apply it to being a trial attorney, or you were a prosecutor for a time. Do you think it helped your career?
I do think it helped my career. And, you know, I think it's interesting. There are certain traits about me that, as I've seen the book being promoted or being reviewed by other people, people will say things like, oh, she's Mormon, you know, that makes sense. Or she's a lawyer, you know, that makes sense. And they're really saying it as, you know, all lawyers should be ashamed that there's somebody who's a sociopath. But did you know that journalism is one of the top 10 careers, professions for sociopaths? And it sort of makes sense too, because what is journalism if not manipulation and trying to get people to care about things that they otherwise wouldn't care about? Even choosing a headline is trying to get people to read, trying to get people to listen, right? The way that you're presenting me in these little breaks, mm-hmm. you know, I'm hiding under the veneer of a Mormon law professor, you know, things like this that are very catchy, trying to get people to think a particular way about something. And that's very much a sociopathic trait. But you're right, law is also a sociopathic trait. And I think in this situation, particularly, it's great that there are sociopaths who are lawyers. And it's great that there are sociopaths in the legal profession, because the legal profession, the justice system, is supposed to be dispassionate. You know, take, for instance, Trayvon Martin trial, George Zimmerman, right? A lot of people saying, you know, very upset about things. But the law is what the law is, right? And yeah, the justice system can be flawed. And I'm not even saying that I know enough to comment on the result. But people have emotions. But we're asked to, when you're a juror, you're asked to be dispassionate. You're asked to set aside your biases, you know, if you can, and to weigh things dispassionately and to search for the truth. And when you're a lawyer, you have a different role. Your job is to advocate very, very strongly on behalf of your client. You're not supposed to think, my client's a bad guy. He deserves prison time. And so I'm just going to slack off and let him, you know, let him lose. You know, that's not your role. You're not supposed to be judge, jury, and executioner. Everybody has their different roles in the legal system. And I think that sociopaths are much better at sort of setting aside their emotions, obviously, than most people, and not empathizing with the victim or not empathizing with other people that they shouldn't be empathizing with, and just looking at the hard, cold facts.
Well, that's easier said than done for most people. I'm just trying to get inside your head and imagine what that's like, to always be sort of detached and not operating on emotions.
Right. So,
when did you even have an awareness of that?
I think that I always had an awareness of that. You know, it took me a while to realize that other people were different. It's so long that I wouldn't say that I truly understood it until law school. I was in law school, and as I said, you're taught to be fairly dispassionate. Mm-hmm. You're taught to think like a lawyer. You're taught to, you know, accept the facts for what they are and think very logically about things. It's considered very rational thought, right? And so we were all learning this skill, and you could kind of see people. Some people were better and quicker at learning it than others. But eventually everybody got around to it. And then in our discussions in law school, we would all think and talk like lawyers. You know, it's almost like that you're being brainwashed to think in this rational sort of way. Except when we would talk about very controversial subjects like abortion or the death penalty. And then I would see my classmates who had been trained to think like lawyers abandon this particular skill, and they would get very, very emotional, and they couldn't be reasoned with in the same way that they could be reasoned with about, you know, what is the best rule for a contract, right? They were very passionate about their beliefs, and I thought, there's something going on here. There's something different from them, because I continued to think like the lawyer, and they reacted in very different emotional ways.
This is very interesting, because I'm thinking while you're speaking here about writers and sociopaths as writers. It's hard to imagine until now, until your book, that a sociopath would ever sit down and acknowledge who they are, what they are, what, you know, these traits, and actually write a memoir about their lives. So you're doing something very unusual. I guess you recognize that.
Yeah, I don't think that I am typical that way. I definitely don't think that I'm typical. No. I don't think that I would have done this particular thing if things hadn't proceeded exactly as they had. You know, I don't think I would have risked certain things if my life hadn't gone the way it had. I don't think there were a lot of things that went into the decision to do it. But I think another weird sort of idiosyncratic thing about me in terms of comparing to other sociopaths is I'm a little bit of a truth seeker. And it's because when I was growing up, I had a father who expressed some narcissistic personality disorder characteristics. And he was a little bit like the minister of propaganda in our family. And he would tell us these things, and we were sort of expected to believe these things. And I really sort of revolted against that. And the rest of my family did as well. And so every time, you know, as we grew older, we became very diligent about making sure that we agreed about our own version of the truth, that we had our own way of assessing the truth and figuring out what the truth was to sort of combat his version of events. So, you know, we'd document things, we'd remember things, we'd challenge him on things. And I think I've taken a little bit of this truth-seeking into the rest of my life and have, you know, to the extent that I value things in life where I find meaning, it's not necessarily emotional meaning, but a lot of my meaning in life comes from finding truth and discovering truth and sort of living by truth. So I think that makes me a little bit atypical.
I will agree that it is provocative to be able to say a lawyer, Sunday school teacher, and sociopath in promoting our discussion today for the listeners of WYPR. You describe yourself as a practicing Mormon who teaches Sunday school and tithes to the Mormon Church. So let's take a look at what exactly that's all like for you as a sociopath and why you think the Mormon Church is a perfect home for sociopaths.
Yeah, well, you said earlier, too, that I was a pillar of the Mormon Church. You know, I don't want to sort of suggest that I am any representative or leader, high-ranking leader of the Mormon Church. I'm not. I am a member of the Mormon Church. I'm a practicing member. I'm a temple recommend holding member of the Mormon Church. I tithe to the Mormon Church. At the time that I was writing the book, I taught Sunday school. I've taught Sunday school, you know, probably for maybe like 5 to 6 years. Everybody in the Mormon Church gets callings, though. Everybody has some sort of role to fulfill. And I think they just like me teaching Sunday school because I'm pretty entertaining. I'm actually a pretty good teacher. And one of the reasons why I'm a good teacher is because I am a little bit manipulative. To the extent that I know what affects things that I say are going to have on people. So if I want to get class discussion, a trick of mine is to say something very sort of controversial that's going to force people to want to respond to things like something like, you know, maybe God doesn't love us as much as we think he does. You know, you say something right, like that in a right. Mormon congregation and people are automatically going to have reactions right. and want to be talking. Right. And I'm not really saying that God doesn't love us as much as we think he does. I'm just trying to get people to think about it in a different way. And I do the same thing when I teach law school. The brainwashing is a lot easier for me to do, I think, than a normal person because I know exactly what to say to get people to flip their paradigm and to think of something in a new way that they're not used to thinking of.
Hmm. And you don't worry about upsetting people? You don't worry about, you know, being seen as outrageous?
I try to be, particularly in church instances, I try to be respectful. You know, I don't try to be outrageous necessarily. And it's very easy to do things. I mean, as you said, you know, journalism, it's very easy to provoke people without being outrageous. There mm-hmm. are people, shock jocks, right, who mm-hmm. are known for being outrageous, but everybody else is doing it in these sort of subtle, prodding ways. And isn't that what journalism is, the hope of journalism is, to get people to see things in different ways, to learn truth? But you can't just shove it down their throats. But how can you open the door so that they're more willing to receive it?
Emmy Thomas, our guest, Confessions of a Sociopath is the book. So, Emmy, I want to take some phone calls and read some emails from our listeners for you. We'll take a call here. This is Carol calling to Baltimore, WYPR from Washington. Hello, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you have for Emmy? Do you have a question?
Well, I'd like to maybe get the discussion to turn the page a little bit. At the beginning of the program, it talked about some of the things that we can notice or some of the things that we can do to help those people in our lives that we may see as being sociopaths. Being a sociopath, I'm not, with all due respect to ME, it's not all roses and wonderful. It really can wreak havoc in the lives of the person who has it, the person that they come in contact with. So, I get the perspective that she's trying to get across. But really, I think enough with that. Let's go on to the next part of this, which is the part that many people suffer through when they are associated with sociopaths.
You mean how can we help them? What can we do for them? I have a question about this, Emmy, so it's a related question. Some people may view the sociopath, without ever using that term, might know someone who has all these traits, or lots of them, and decide, well, I don't like this person. I don't have anything to do with this person anymore. This is a manipulative, cunning, lying person who just sort of used me, so that ends that relationship. So the idea of trying to help someone, I guess maybe a relative, someone you care about, do people struggle with this, caring about the sociopath?
I think some people struggle with it, and I'm not one to say that I do not mean to whitewash sociopathy in any sort of way. My whole argument is let's look at the balance of everything. Let's weigh all things in the balance. And I think to say that sociopaths do bad things is very clear. I mean, everybody does bad things. Drug addicts do bad things, right? The drug addicts are actually a good example. So drug addicts do a bad thing. They wreak havoc in other people's lives. What is the answer to drug addicts? Maybe for some people, it is to not associate with them and say, you know, this person lies to me. This person manipulates me. This person abuses me emotionally or physically. And I just don't want to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And is that fine for people to decide? Yeah. I don't think that there's anything wrong with saying you don't want to associate with a drug addict or a sociopath or anybody else that you consider a net negative in your life. But as a society, can we all just abandon drug addicts? Can we all just abandon sociopaths? I guess we could, but what would the result be? You know, they wouldn't get the sort of help that they would need, right? And they're not completely avoidable. So then the question, I guess, becomes what can we do to help them possibly? Or how can I better interact with this particular person? What sort of methods can I use to get better results, you know, particularly if the sociopath or the drug addict, you know, continuing the analogy in your life, is somebody that you can't really get away from. They're a relative of yours. They're, you know, a co-parent maybe. They are a co-worker of yours. And I think those are very legitimate questions.
Since writing the blog, have you spoken to other sociopaths? And I mean people, you know, diagnosed with this.
Yes, I interact with all sorts of different sociopaths. And I think interacting with them, you realize there is such a heterogeneity. And this is another good example. You know, as I said, I'm not typical. I'm not a typical sociopath. I don't even know if there is a typical sociopath. There are so many different types of sociopaths, just like there's so many different types of people who are, for instance, drug addicts. You know, there's so many different types of criminals. There's so many different types of anybody, really. You know, I don't think that there is a typical any person. I don't think most of us are normal. I think maybe 40% represent kind of the majority, what we consider to be a normal neurotypical brain. And then everybody else is something else.
Let's take a call before our next break. Dory in Annapolis, we'll go to you next. You're on with M.E. Thomas. Hi.
Hi. My question is, are you familiar, M.E., with the RAD, reactive attachment disorder? And I was wondering whether that disorder is something that is always attached to a sociopath.
Reactive attachment disorder, I'm not sure what that is. Not attaching to a parent early in life, or what is that?
Yeah, a child that never bonds to anyone. As an infant, as a toddler, just
okay.
Never bonds.
Bonding. All right. Thank you very much.
Right. So I don't know that much about it, but the typical stories, right, are these Romanian children, I guess, who grew up in the orphanages, and although they had all of their physical needs attended to, they weren't held. They spent all their time in their crib. They never got the sort of interaction, human touch that they needed to develop the way that they should. And I don't necessarily know if there's a connection. I do think it's a very good example of how everybody develops. Their brain is developing when they're a child, when you're an infant particularly, in ways that can affect the rest of your life severely. So an example I use in the book is this feral child. I think her name is Danielle, and she was raised basically until she was 5 or 6 in a dark closet and was still wearing diapers and didn't speak. And she's never going to be able to speak. She's never going to be verbal. She's never going to speak English. She's never going to speak anything. And it's because she missed those windows of development while she was growing up. And now she's this particular way. So I think particularly when you think about sociopaths, yeah, there are treatments. And sociopaths do bad things. But to also consider what happened in a sociopath's life to have them be this particular way. You know, there's some sort of genetic component, as we talked about. There's something else going on, environmental. And there have been studies that suggest that, you know, violence when they're young, or as people have said, you don't form the same sorts of connections as an infant or as a small child, a baby, to your parents, emotional connections or physical connections. That's for sure going to trigger some of these antisocial traits. But, you know, when they're like that, you can't really blame them, can you? A lot of people think that sociopaths, they bring it on themselves. You know, to what extent do they bring it on themselves? They're making choices, I guess, but they're making choices the same way that other people are making choices. You know, they're more similar to these other disorders, to things like autism, than people really think.
Emmy Thomas, our guest in this hour of midday on WYPR. Her book is Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight. A short break on midday. We'll come back and take some more calls, read some more emails, and I have more questions for Emmy. Just a moment. Confessions of a Sociopath, Emmy Thomas, our guest. I wanted to read a couple of emails for you. This one from Den in Chestertown, Maryland. It says, I have weeded out sociopaths many times during my lengthy career. I'm now retired and very early developed the capacity to perceive false friendship. I have dealt with them according to two guidelines. One, if they were merely trying to manipulate or harm me, I would veer onto a different course, leaving them behind as quickly as possible. And two, if I perceived that they were a threat of any kind to my wife, my children, or my dog, I would go for their jugular, metaphorically speaking, of course. And I would not stop until they realized that it was in their own benefit to avoid me and mine like the Black Plague. You have to do what you have to do in this life, Den says. So Den seems to have picked up a good eye or ear for the sociopath. And there's his reaction to it. Emmy, any comment on what he had to say about that?
Well, I do think that some people are better able to detect sociopaths than other people. There have been certain people in my life, you know, somebody I just sat next to at a basketball game, somebody who was a coworker, a temporary coworker for a month, that have been able to pick up things about me that people who have known me for years have been blind to. So I don't really necessarily doubt his ability to weed out sociopaths. There is a little bit of a vigilante.
Yeah, a little bit. It was a little strong.
Theme.
A little strong there.
Right, and I understand if they're trying to manipulate them, then he's going to leave them. Does that suggest that if they're not manipulating him, then he has friends? He's friends with sociopaths. He also says that if they're a threat, he goes for their jugular and he doesn't stop until they realize, you know, that he, to avoid him like the Black Plague. You know, I think that's sort of an interesting thing to say about people. And I think, you know, I don't mean any disrespect to Dan who wrote in, but you could substitute a lot of different things in there, things that people there's not such a stigma associated with them. You know, you could say the same thing about, you know, lower socioeconomic children, you know, or like the Black youth in his neighborhood, you know, and then he would sound completely like a maniac. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I don't mean to suggest that he is being maniacal, and I'm sure, you know, everybody has, there are people out there who have had really bad experiences with sociopaths, but to the extent that you say that you make these sort of generalizations, you know, it makes me sort of question whether or not there's more stigma or prejudice involved.
A quick email from Joseph, who's a criminal defense attorney, and then we're going to hear from another lawyer. I think someone who wants to comment on your earlier comments about attorneys. You're being one yourself, Emmy. Joseph says, I am a criminal defense attorney who has represented child molesters and other really bad people. I've recently realized that my sociopathy has helped me do my job better. Thank you for this program. He doesn't elaborate on how it might have helped him do his job better. Maybe the detachment you're talking about earlier, the lack of emotional attachment of any kind. Charles in Baltimore wanted to add something to this. Charles, thanks for calling Midday.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I took question with the idea that thinking like a lawyer means not being able to be empathetic, not being tuned to people's emotions. I don't think that's true. I think lawyers are supposed to be taught to think carefully and rationally, but that doesn't mean that there isn't consideration of the human elements. We don't ask jurors just to take a slide rule or a computer and measure things. We expect jurors to determine whether or not they think somebody is telling the truth. We expect jurors to be able to determine things about the intent of people. So I just can't believe that this is... I'm assuming, Dan, that you've checked out all these credentials, that she actually is a law professor. because it doesn't ring true to me.
Well, there's been some others have done some work on that that I've read about, and I didn't allow for that on the air too much today. I don't know if we want to get into that because there was so much ground to cover here. But others have been checking out M.E. Thomas, and it sounds to me generally from my producer and myself, between the two of us, that this story holds up. She teaches law, has been an attorney, is a member of the Mormon Church. I don't know what more you what doesn't hold up for you though, Charles. What doesn't hold up for you?
Well, the idea that thinking like a lawyer, which I agree should be careful thinking and rational thinking, mm-hmm. but that a component of it is not understanding the emotions of other people.
Charles, I don't mean to misrepresent that, particularly when we're talking about constitutional law and we're talking about people's individual rights. I think a lot of our understanding of what is an individual right comes from people's intuitive moral sense of, you know, people should not be slaves. People are not property. These sorts of things where we may not have the same sorts of rational reasons. I didn't mean to say that thinking like a lawyer is to the complete exclusion, but there are definitely areas, antitrust, intellectual property, contract law, where you would expect to see a little bit less moral reasoning. And these skills of being rational, part of thinking like a lawyer is being able to separate the rational reasoning from your moral intuitions and to understand what is coming from where. And as you said, jurors are not supposed to bring in their emotions and their personal feelings and their biases. You say they're supposed to ascertain whether people are telling the truth, to ascertain other people's intent. We're asking them to use their common sense. We're asking them to use their basic skills. We're not necessarily asking them to empathize with people. So I guess I don't understand what your issue is there either.
As far as the authenticity of the book and your life and what you say about yourself, I mean, others have tried to out you, right, publicly here in the last couple of months since the book came out. How do you answer people who say, you know, they just don't buy it? What do you say to them?
I really don't understand it. I mean, I see people sometimes say that I'm a fraud, and I think, what sort of fraud? What are they meaning I'm a fraud? I'm not who I say I am? Because these things are very factually easily ascertainable and verifiable. Mm. Do they mean that they don't think that I'm a sociopath? Because I never say I'm a sociopath. I've been diagnosed as a sociopath. I think what they mean when they say fraud is that they have a real issue with the fact that of my message, that I am a person that has been walking amongst you, and there you statistically have met another sociopath that's just like me or thinks like me, has similar traits to me, and you haven't been able to identify them. And it also suggests that there are people out there who are able to succeed who don't have empathy, who don't have this same sense of conscience that you do, who see the world differently than you. And that, I think, is scary to people. It's the same reason that we have been persecuting minorities throughout the millennia.
Amy, let me ask you this. Have you ever felt violent or violence toward someone, wanting to commit violence towards someone? And this idea of ruining people, messing people up, that you found delicious at different times in your life. Could you talk about those two things first? Violence and just the idea of ruining somebody's life or creating havoc in someone's life.
Right. I mean, I do enjoy violence. I go see movies and I see violent movies. And when things happen, I say, oh, yeah, he got it in the head or whatever it is. But I don't think that I'm unique in this either. Violence has its own particular aesthetic. And anybody who has seen a horror film understands what that aesthetic might be. You experience your own sort of fight or flight instinct, right? You have an adrenaline rush, right? Violence, there's a reason why when people get in a fight, that people surround the people in a fight and they get excited and that we watch boxing and wrestling and mixed martial arts. There's a reason why all these things are popular. And so sociopaths do experience the same sort of appreciation for violence, I think, that most people do. I wouldn't say that most sociopaths experience bloodlust, and I certainly don't. Although I can't say that there's nothing appealing about violence. There is. Do I think that violence is destructive and inefficient sometimes? And do I actively participate in violence? You know, I don't. I do understand that violence is a bad idea. Right. And
yeah, but
I'm a rational person.
But I wonder, because we associate sociopaths and psychopaths with violence, with criminality, going back to the beginning of our discussion. Had you ever,
I think it's absurd. You know what? People also have started associating, not as popular, autism with violence. And they say these kids with autism, they'll throw tantrums and they'll punch people and they'll hit people and they'll do horrible things. There have been people who are murderers, who people say are autistic. You know, these sorts of things, they happen in every population. Every population is going to have people who express violence. They're going to feel differently about violence. Maybe people with autism don't understand violence the same way that a normal person does. Similarly, people with sociopathy won't understand violence the same way a normal person does. But sociopaths are rational. That is the key characteristic. That's why they're not crazy. That's why they can't get off on the insanity defense. That's why if they do get caught, it's not going to be a mitigating circumstance that will reduce their sentence, that the fact that they're a sociopath. If anything, they're going to get more time, and they're not going to get paroled because they're a sociopath, right? So it's not – sociopaths are rational. If there are rational reasons why we do things, sociopaths are going to understand them. And if there aren't rational reasons for our moral rules – then I don't know why we keep perpetuating those particular moral rules.
All right. So a couple of things here toward the end of our hour. These are important things. Relationships, love relationships. You, in one of your blog posts, you talk about love and sociopaths. And what if you realize your partner is a sociopath? Can that person really love you?
A sociopath can love you. Is it going to look exactly the same as the way that you love him? Probably not. But the way that we love each other is so idiosyncratic, I think. It's much more unique to the person, and it's much more culturally dependent than people realize. A love like an emotion like love is very complex, right? And it's made up of a lot of different types of emotions. For me, when I feel love, it's primarily gratitude. It's maybe 60 to 70% gratitude. So the longer I know a person, the more likely I am to love them. Okay. There are other aspects to it. Maybe I adore them. Maybe I'm infatuated with them. But yeah, they're going to love you. It's just going to look different than your particular cocktail of love.
Okay. If I determine that you're a sociopath, doesn't that end the relationship? I mean, these questions about being a friend with a sociopath, it just seems so contradictory to me. But you're saying you have friends and that it's
yes.
possible to be a friend with a sociopath.
Yeah, I have friends who some of my friends, I think, love me in spite of it, right? And some of my friends love me because of some of these sociopathic characteristics. If you have a problem, I'm a great person to come to. I'm going to cut right to the quick of what exactly is going on with your problem. I'm not going to insert my own emotional needs. I'm going to be very sort of rational. You're not always going to want that response.
Right.
Maybe you want a shoulder to cry on, but...
Right. But other times you want sort of the response you're describing there. It has its appeal.
Exactly. You want somebody to stick up for you. You want somebody to be completely loyal who can say, you know, I would do anything for you and absolutely mean it.
Mark writes in by email to say that he finds your openness about your personality disorder both refreshing and disquieting. Maybe that's the effect that you were looking for here. I'm just curious. We only have about a minute left. What's been the reaction to the book? What have you heard from people?
You know, I would say that the reaction has been mixed and it's been very polarizing. That's probably the quickest response. I would say that I've gotten more of a negative reaction than I thought. I thought initially maybe 4 out of 10 people would absolutely hate it. And that seems to be more like 7 out of 10 hate it. Then and just hate everything about it. And then I thought, you know, maybe 1 in 10 would like it. And that has turned out to be true, where 1 in 10 people say it's changed their life. The other people, you know, they think it's interesting, but they ultimately still hate sociopaths.
Well, we're not going to say that about you. This is a provocative book, and I appreciate your insight here. It's given us things to think about, M.E. Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep, we're out of time. M.E. Thomas's book, again, Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hiding in Plain Sight, Crown News, the publisher. Crown is the publisher. Thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. We'll see you again soon.
Midday is produced by Nikki Gamer and Sean Yost. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. The director and engineer is John Ahrens. Our interns are Rachel Schultes, Megumi Kiwamoto, Abigail Pedroni, Zachary Gooding, Jacob Siegel, and Jason Van Slyke. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR. Your NPR news station.